they kind of briefly talked about traveling to the Himalayas to take the photo, and then everyone was like, I don't want to do that. Let's just go outside. Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of 1001 Album Complaints, the show where lifelong friends and musicians break down some of the most influential albums of all time, chosen randomly from Robert Dimery's book, 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. We've got ourselves a steady job here every week, telling you the story of these records, how they got made, playing clips along the way to illustrate what we're talking about, and in the end, we vote on whether or not you need to hear this before you die. I should mention that first and foremost, we are fans of music. We have great respect and reverence for anyone who puts pen to paper or song to tape. And yet, we love to have a laugh and nitpick some of the details. So, sleep, little darlings, do not cry. We shall be poking some fun at these Liverpool lads today. For our auspicious 150th episode celebration after the long, cold, lonely winter, we asked you, dear audience, and you picked the Beatles' Abbey Road. And since last week, we exhaustively, and I do mean exhaustively, went through all of side one on this great album. This week, for episode 151, we're tackling side two. So let's play a short clip from side two of Abbey Road. This is a song called She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. Okay, and now let's meet our panelists, our fellow complainers, by way of a tweet-length review. Let's throw it around the room. I'm going to throw it first to Tom.
All right, thank you, Rob. My review, my tweet-length review of side two of Abbey Road is, in a complete boosh to every other band putting out music in 1969, Lennon and McCartney prove that they can take even their unfinished cast-off song ideas and make a better back half of a record than anyone else making music at the time.
Excellent. Okay, nice. Let's throw it next to Phil.
Moog synths, massive orchestral arrangements, 12-tone composition, self-referential song sequences. Does this remain the high watermark for a conceptual rock and roll sequence?
Stay tuned to find out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I suspect we'll answer it somewhere over the next 2 hours. Let's kick it now to Alan.
You know, I take pride in trying to come up with some sort of like funny, pithy tweets. It's part of the fun that I have with this whole deal. But at the risk of sounding a bit hagiographic, which is a word that I learned from my friend Rob not too long ago, I'm just going to say this contains the greatest 6-minute stretch of recorded music that exists on a pop record.
Nice.
Hard disagree.
Adam, what say you?
Hey, this is Adam, and my quick tweet is a 22-minute masterpiece, an emotional roller coaster and fitting end that still satisfies the age-old show business adage of leave 'em wanting more.
Excelente. Okay, this is Rob here. I'm going to be walking us down the second half, the second side of Abbey Road, talking about the sessions where these are recorded and kind of the aftermath of when the Beatles broke up. And so I have a tweet for you shortly, but also we put the call out to you listeners for the first time ever, and we asked for some pre-tweets about Abbey Road. So we have a couple of good ones here. I'm going to read those first. Listener Gordon writes, unfortunately, there's no footage of the Beatles working on Abbey Road because after the Get Back sessions, they instituted a don't bloody film us anymore policy. However, fans can get a glimpse thanks to the avant-garde Japanese artist and top secret spy photographer, Yoko Ono. Thank goodness she was notorious for leaving her camera unattended, where any quick-thinking waiter, primal scream therapist, or heroin dealer could just yoink it and run off to have the film developed.
Can I vote that we let our people crowdsource all of our tweet length reviews?
Yeah, these are good. I think
there's gold out there.
I want to read one from a close friend of the show and sometimes guest, Tony, wrote in to us. Unbeknownst to most fans and even their bandmates, a young Lennon and McCartney made a secret pact to end the Beatles the moment they released an album where the best song was written by George Harrison. Adding insult to injury, George went on to write the two best songs on Abbey Road. John, Paul, here comes the boosh.
Nice. Tony, that's awesome.
Excellent work, Tony. Have to have you back soon with your pithy wit. And this is Rob here. Like I said, we're going to tell a little of the story. We're going to talk general impressions, and we're going to walk through every single song on side two of Abbey Road. So strap in. Here is my tweet length review. Fake Italian stealing from Fleetwood Mac and characters that ought to have stayed snugly inside of the yellow submarine at the bottom of the sea. The Beatles decide they need a symphony to close things out because their catalog thus far is sadly lacking in musical ambition.
Okay. Yeah, what did John say? Is this supposed to be some kind of concept album or something like that? It's like, no, it's just ambitious.
Okay, let's do a relatively quick round, y'all, of general impressions. Let's dive a little deeper on what we're feeling about side two. We did some of that on side one, obviously, and it in some ways referenced this. But before we get to the background of the songs, let's talk a little bit general impressions of side two.
Side two is very emotional for me. And the only reason I think it's emotional is because A, nostalgia, but much like in a movie that you love and you've seen 100 times, and there's that one scene near the end where you realize, oh, like we're on the way out. The movie's about to end and you get a little sad. I feel that about a very specific point on side two where I hear it and I just get bummed out because I know that not only is the album ending, but that it also was the end of the Beatles. With the foresight that I now have.
I don't have that experience with any albums where like something happens and I get the feeling like, oh no, it's coming to an end.
You know what that makes me think of, Adam, is the SNL closing music. Whenever that comes on, I get a little twinge of something.
That's a great call.
Is a great comp, yes.
Well, all right, let me just jump in and say, this is like everything the Beatles do well. Everything's here. They go from triumphant to silly to wild, crazy harmony to poignant. It really has the feeling of a victory lap. And it's, of course, the second side, as we know, is dominated by this medley with all these different styles in it. Again, I was struck, we said it on side one too, I was struck by how many different musical styles come together and how this idea of a medley with different styles, maybe this sounds weird to you guys, but the comp in my head was stuff like Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon. Oh, every track runs together. Sure. That's kind of what's happening here, but it's a completely different way of thinking about a medley or running things together because they unabashedly switch even approaches to songwriting. And my last thought, and I alluded to it in the first side, and I think it's true of the first side too, this is where Paul really shines.
Oh, yeah.
I think something that like stood out to me is that I definitely get the impression that many of the things they were shooting for on the White Album sort of came to fruition here. I think John experimented a lot with like that songwriting style that I guess Paul would sort of master or really come to love, right? The sort of like several mini songs, like the Wing stuff, like Band on the Run, Live and Let Die, Uncle Albert. Right? These are all like little...
Oh, yes. I had... Yeah, Uncle Albert was definitely one that cropped up,
And this sort of does the same thing. And like a song like Happiness is a Warm Gun does the same thing as well. So I think this is like them finding common ground on that approach.
This is the culmination of the Beatles.
Totally.
This is everything that the Beatles have been doing and working towards coalescing into a fucking masterpiece. It really is. It is from beginning to end. I'm not going to say flawless. There's only one part that I'm going to complain about, and it's a very quick part, but I will complain about this one part. But everything else, I think, is executed perfectly. Down to when you get the beginning of I think it's at the beginning of Sun King, where it just sounds like the crickets. There's crickets in the background. Like, that's so, how fucking good and tasteful is that? It's so good. Everything that they do on this side of the album is them realizing their potential. And when I say them, I am mostly talking about Lennon and McCartney, because I do think that the Harrison song that opens it is fantastic, but after that, it just becomes the John and Paul show.
Well, and mostly the Paul show, like, especially as you get towards the end, which we'll kind of talk about. But I agree, it's the culmination, and not even in a way that, you know, you might think it's these guys that are hanging back as like the maestros that are intentionally writing their own ending of like, ha, we've fucking, you know, we conquered the world and let's just do the shit out of this. I really think it was a lot of the stitch work that brought together some of these things that by themselves might not have made a lot of sense together. But it was that, you know, we talked about this concept of like mastery in the last episode. I think this is really where it comes to bear. Even if a lot of this stuff was not intentionally meant to get sewn together, it just fucking works. And I almost can't listen to this album like on a piecemeal basis. Like I feel like, especially this side, like you're either all in totally. Or what's the point of even like putting it on?
I feel like this first two songs are the only ones that stand alone as songs. She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. I've seen an example of someone else redoing that, so I can sort of stomach it. But otherwise, like, yeah, I agree. Once You Never Give Me Your Money kicks off, I'm in for the ride.
Alan, you talked about the mastery of the stitching together, even in the sequencing of the songs. You put these in a different order, it doesn't work as well.
We'll dig into it more, but there is a gung-ho change made in the sequence, and we could talk about it later.
Oh, like an audible where they were like, "Oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yes, that's fantastic."
Nay, a mistake, a beautiful mistake. But we're gonna get to that. So let's get into a little background, and then we're gonna dive into the songs. I'm sure we're all excited to do that. Before I dive in and tell a little more of this Beatles story, which we began on last week's episode about Side One, kind of the lead up to the most of the Abbey Road sessions in the summer of 1969. Before I get into the Side Two, the continuation of that story, I want to give some bibliographical credit here. I mentioned it on last week's episode. I've read a lot about this album. I'm sure we all have. I've been reading about it most of my life. I'm sure you guys all have too. But I pulled a lot of details from this guy Scott Freiman's lecture series called Deconstructing the Beatles. It's admirably exhaustive. It's entertaining. He has long pieces, audiovisual tidbits, pictures, isolated tracks, all that kind of stuff, different takes. And he does it for almost, I think, all the Beatles albums are up on his website. So check out Deconstructing the Beatles if you're curious, credit where credit's due for a lot of these details. So where we left off, the four lads from Liverpool had taken some time apart after a few recording sessions in the early part of 1969, but now they have agreed to record a new record together with George Martin at Abbey Road Studios, known as EMI at the time, which we talked about. And if you want more of the story leading up to those sessions or how they came to that decision, or perhaps most important, what the heck these millionaires were even fighting about, again, go back an episode if you haven't listened to our Side One episode yet. So basically all of July and August 1969 are booked at Abbey Road. The first week, however, and we already mentioned this last week, but Lennon is out because he has a car accident while he's on vacation in Scotland. He needs like 17 stitches. It's semi-serious, I guess. And Yoko, who's actually pregnant with Sean at the time, hurts her back. But his old pals, the Beatles, are like, fuck it, let's start without him, right? So you can see maybe where the...
They're both smacked up on heroin. They'll be fine. The pain's going to go away real fast.
Jesus. To be honest, I kind of tried to dig into this. I couldn't get a beat on whether this was Lennon's suggestion, because he does seem kind of checked out of the Beatles at the moment. He seems the least interested. And if you recall, when Paul was approaching George Martin about getting together for another record, even George Martin kind of knew that. He's like, even does John want to do this? Like, he's the one I'm really wondering about. Or if it was the Beatles just saying, you know what, we're not waiting for you anymore, let's just start.
The thing also that I found very interesting, and you mentioned it in the previous episode, is that Give Peace a Chance had been released relatively recently. And I found it to be very interesting that George Harrison took that as permission to record All Things Must Pass. That was his permission to say, oh, somebody put out a solo project. That means I get to do that now too.
Green light.
Because he had said something to the effect of, I've already written enough Beatles songs for the next 10 years worth of Beatles albums, saying it in a snarky way, like I only get one or two songs on an album. So I already have enough songs to be on the next 10 Beatles albums if I want to. And then he kind of was like, you know what? Fuck this. Instead of waiting 10 years to put all these songs out, I can just make my own album.
I got 10 more old Brown shoes right here, guys. I can't believe you guys are digging into this gold.
I think in many ways, All Things Must Pass is the most successful post-Beatles Beatles record. He just sort of leans into a sound. He has an all-star crew. It has a vibe that doesn't really appear in the Beatles catalog, like in that way.
It's got Eric Clapton, who Phil loves.
Listen,
we're going to get to that. We're going to get to post-Beatles.
yeah, right.
Let's not get waylaid here like John did in Scotland. So either way, he's not there for the beginning of the sessions, and it probably creates some resentment, regardless of whose decision it was, right? And they do work on some songs without Lennon there, like Here Comes the Sun and Her Majesty, for instance, right? And at this point, before Lennon even shows up, they've decided that side two is going to be this long medley. So when Lennon does rejoin, he brings in Yoko, who's bedridden. We already mentioned this last week. They bring a hospital bed into the studio, which is already ridiculous. He requests a microphone. She's laying down, mind you. And the microphone is hanging above her face so that she can comment on the proceedings. And
I'm imagining the guy from Breaking Bad with a bell that he's just whenever he wants to communicate, he
she just screams into it every once in a while.
Seriously. Let me recontextualize this a little. You're at work, and someone's significant other who does not work at your company is in the room in a hospital bed dictating to the whole team what should be going on based on what she's hearing through like a fucking can attached to a string. Holy shit.
Please don't tell me you can't imagine Elon Musk doing this, though.
Holy shit.
And I think it even goes a level further than that, because you're at work, but it's also like you're like a civil engineer or something. You have a very highly specific set of skills that allows you to do this work. And some fucking joker is just like, hey, maybe we should do something different. You're like, you don't know what you're fucking talking about. You have no talent whatsoever in this field.
I need to add more context, because then you also get a window into their personal behind closed doors, what should stay behind closed doors relationship, when your coworker is calling his significant other mother. That is, you don't need to know that. You don't want to know that. But here's the thing. Here's the flip side, is that it might have been seen as an improvement by McCartney and Harrison, because keep in mind, in the Get Back sessions, she's sitting in a chair touching John's thigh and, you know, could be touching Paul's thigh at the same time as they are trying to work as a band and present new songs and things like that. So at least in this case, she has a little bit of distance.
That's just love.
We talked about that on the Get Back, on the Let It Be episode, is that that circle of musicians is like a sacred thing. You don't get to be in the fucking circle. You can be in the room. Even that's kind of annoying, but there is a clear delineation of people playing music and people not playing music, and you don't get to sit in the circle if you're not participating in the music.
You know, I don't feel as harshly as you do about that, Tom, but it does make me actually think of something slightly different but on point here, which is like, has anybody ever been at a concert and somebody in the crowd has like a percussion instrument and they're like playing along?
Tambourine ladies. Tambourine.
Oh my God, that's the one, man. That's the one that'll ruin it for everyone. So if you're listening and you've ever considered doing this, this is stop. Yeah. This is a bad move.
Watch that Chuck Berry video where she's actually on stage, where she's not just there as a like faux collaborative member, where she's on stage with two of the greatest rock musicians or rock blues, whatever you want to call it, musicians of all time, and is just allowed to scream into the microphone. Like, it just tells you all you need to know.
That Bill Burr breakdown is the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Good.
Wait, before we move on, though, you really shouldn't bring a tambourine to a concert and play it from the crowd. I just want
to
say that.
There's a lot of things you shouldn't bring to a concert. Tambourine's definitely one of them, though.
You also shouldn't bring a bed for your wife to a recording
session.
Good call.
Okay, so John gets there with Yoko, and McCartney catches him up on all the stuff they've been working on, which is a lot of side A is now complete, basically. And he pitches him the side two medley, which George Martin is also fully on board for and excited about. And they tell him, oh, it's like a symphony. It's going to be like Sgt. Pepper's. Lennon is completely unimpressed.
Of course.
And then they're like, well, how about you add your songs to it? He's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's better. spotty results, questionable results maybe, but we'll get into that. They're calling it the long one as they're recording it. They don't really have clarity on exactly what it's going to be yet. There's fragments of things going back to, like we already said, the White Album days, snippets of songs. August rolls around, and they've actually done a lot of the tracking. They haven't done any of the sequencing yet. And August rolls around, and at this point, it's mostly overdubs for the record. But I wanted to highlight a few key days, moments in August 1969 in our favorite segment, Abbey Roadside 2 by the numbers. Let's talk about some numbers from August. We're going to make this into a little countdown. First number I want to throw out to you is 38. That's the size of the orchestra that rolls in for overdubs on August 15th. We're talking 12 violins.
Damn.
Four violas, four cellos, a string bass, three trumpets, two clarinets, two alto flutes, two regular flutes, two piccolos, four other horns. I don't even know what that means. One trombone.
Other horns, yeah. Those the other horns are the ones I want to know more about.
French horn, bugle, I don't know.
Flugel.
But here's the kicker is there's one bass trombone.
Dope. Mm.
Well, there could have been two bass trombones if they moved Yoko out of the way and made it
more. Exactly.
Seriously, though, what sonically is the difference on a recording between 12 violin players and six violin players? Can anybody tell the
George
difference?
George Martin
there?
Will tell you.
He's
George
just padding the budget. George Martin is the guy. He owns like a, you know, like a string production company.
That's why they don't make any money. Okay.
Well, maybe it's like, you know, in the work world, if you don't use the budget, then like finance claws it back.
You lose it, right? He's got to keep.
A chorusing, you know, man. Just trying to. John doesn't want a multi-track. Didn't we cover this?
I believe at this point they have signed that next lucrative record deal that they were looking to do with Al, yeah. You know, Alan Klein helped them do it. And yes, so maybe they're getting a little more spendy right now. It's possible.
Well, I think George Martin's pulling the whatever the name of was of the studio that recorded that Slipknot first album, where they're just like, you know, it's a per member fee here, and you're like, listen, you got the more than 10 violin player tax that we kind of put on.
It's
there.
Bulk so pricing at that point, which actually goes up, yes. Surprisingly.
I can confidently project that is the first time Slipknot and the Beatles have ever been lumped together in conversation.
Actually, the Beatles came up on the Slipknot episode. You'd know that if you listened to our show, you piece of shit.
I'm just trying to keep the listeners on their toes here.
I mean, hitting a keg with a baseball bat and hitting an anvil with Maxwell's similar hammer, they're kind of similar.
Pretty close.
Yeah, it's not that okay. Bad. Let's get the next number. The next number is 10. This is a little side journey.
The hours that this podcast is going
to
go.
10 is the... 10 is the number of minutes the police agreed to stop traffic to take the iconic cover photo. Even the Beatles can't catch a real break at that freaking intersection. They walked out there at like 10 a.m. on August 8th to take this photo. And we're going to get into other things they did in the lead up to that. But one thing I thought was funny is they considered calling the record Everest at one point, which was the brand of cigarettes that engineer Jeff Emmerich was smoking. And then they kind of briefly talked about traveling to the Himalayas to take the photo. And then everyone was like, I don't want to do that. Let's just go outside. So like laziness really saves the day and creates the most iconic album cover of all time.
They really, that's quite a swing from like, let's go to the least accessible place in the world to let's walk out our front door.
You don't want to take those kind of like, alcohol, cigarette, and heroin habits to Tibet. Like, that's just not where you don't want to take it there.
Acclimate yourself to the elevation for 6 weeks so you can get a picture.
Yeah. It's like, dude, just try out like 17,000 feet as like a starting point. Just good luck.
Okay. Speaking of that photo session, the next number I want to throw out to you is 6. That is the total number of photographs they snapped in that session. And you can find these other shots online. And what surprised me was they really don't seem to have the clearest idea for what this is even going to be. Three shots are them walking back the other direction. A couple of them have Paul wearing sandals. They chose the only one that really captures them in full stride, seemingly by accident. Like, they just feel like they're just naturally walking across the street. He snaps 6 photos, and they happen to get this really good one. The best album cover of all time.
Are there, wow. like, some out of... focus photos, like what? They must have run more film than that, right?
Maybe 6 were the only negatives they decided to print, but the other ones are not good. That's what I'm trying to tell you. You can't see their faces. Yeah, they don't have the stride thing going on. It's just, it seemed really strange to me. And we should point out to listeners who might not know that they're out in front of the studio and they're walking away from the studio. Implication that they knew about was that they're leaving the studio, maybe for the last time. It is the last time, right? I think for the longest time when I was a kid, I thought they were walking into the studio, but that's not the case.
Oh, yeah, I could see that.
Is there any indication as to why Paul's barefoot? That led to the whole Paul is dead thing, right?
What is it? The Undertaker, the priest?
Right? The Paul is dead thing is so fun, by the way. I mean, it's completely bonkers. It goes back to like Mystery Tour, right? And it insinuates that there's like a body double. Which, man, that's fun. I hope that's true.
let's talk about it, because yeah, I have a little piece on that. The album cover helped popularize the myth. The myth being that Paul had died sometime in the past and been replaced by a stand-in Paul, and that the other Beatles felt so guilty about it that they were dropping clues. For instance, in the photograph, the Abbey Road photograph, he's got a cigarette in his right hand, but he's left-handed.
Ooh.
And one of the license plates also in the photograph says 28 if, as in 28 if Paul was still alive, except really he was 27 at this time, but you know, these are details.
I'm picturing Robert Stack walking out with his trench coat for Unsolved Mysteries.
The idea that you would find someone who looks exactly like Paul McCartney that is actually slightly better at songwriting and performing these songs, yeah. Because he's maturing as a musician, is completely insane.
Yeah. Turns out that this body double is a real fucking taskmaster, and he just will not let him
this
be
guy's a fucking ace. Who hired this guy?
All he does is write happy songs about serial killers.
Seriously.
Okay, let's keep it going here. The next number I want to throw out to you is 3. That's the number of Beatles songs covered by other artists at the Woodstock Festival taking place in this month, August 15th to 18th in New York, 1969. Now, the Beatles were invited to attend, but decided not to. However, during the show, Richie Havens does Here Comes the Sun. Joe Cocker does With a Little Help from My Friends. And Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young sings Blackbird. Strong argument right here for the fact that the group is still on top in terms of influence and artistry. That's why I bring it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, great call.
And last near meaningless piece of trivia, number 1, the number of Beatles songs that starts on a C sharp minor chord. Any guesses?
Only Beatles song that starts on a C sharp minor chord?
It's Because.
It is Because.
I did a deep dive on this today. We'll talk more later.
I got to be honest. I read that. I attempted to fact check it. I did not go through every song in the Beatles book. So Beatles nerds, if you want to prove me wrong, feel free. But that stat is out there. It is Because. Okay, that ends August 1969, the time of Woodstock, the time of cultural change, the time of the Manson murders, the time of Altamont just about. And speaking of generation-defining events, we made a new show called Song Battle, the best of the 90s.
That is a hell of a transition. Yeah, well done, sir. Yeah.
That's pretty
great,
ace.
Great,
I want to say.
Hey, yes.
I thought you were going to do a You Never Give Me Your Money transition into the Patreon thing.
Oh, but that would have been nice.
We love every one of you for listening to this podcast. We see the numbers grow every week. You guys write to us. We appreciate it. Our mailing list grows. Our Patreon community has been growing. The response has been amazing. And we've started doing bonus content over there. So we have a full round of our new show, Song Battle, the best of the 90s, where we all come with contender songs and we argue and tell some of the history behind the songs and argue about which one is the best. And we've already scheduled, and I believe since we're taping this a little bit early, the first episode may already be out, the next edition of Song Battle entitled March Radness, the Best of the 80s. You can get all that as bonus content over on Patreon. It's $5 a month. Buy us a beer. We're going to continue to bring you this weekly show for free every single week. And we love you no matter how you want to support us. Thank you.
Should we be informing our audience that we actually recorded last week's episode and this week's episode all in one sitting? And so we're going to be like 4 hours into a fucking podcast recording.
So if we start losing it on this episode, you understand, you understand why.
I can already feel myself getting loopier. You guys are getting funnier.
Hell yeah. Dude, I'm getting a couple beers in, loosening it up.
I definitely poured some whiskey on that.
Okay. All right, let's keep it moving over to the song. So they're starting to think about sequencing now, and apparently the mood is somewhat happy, maybe in part because they kind of know it might be the last time they're going to be together. And they very purposely, as we're going to talk about with the songs, they end both sides very abruptly. The last official session ever, the last official session for the album, they don't know it's going to be the last session ever, but it ends up being the last one ever, was August 25th, where three of the Beatles showed up to mix side one. Guess where John was instead?
Shooting dope.
He was going through heroin withdrawal at the time, oh, so kind of the opposite. God.
Bummer.
Now, flash forward just a little bit. We'll just talk about the aftermath, and then we'll get into the songs. On September 14th, Lennon says in an interview that though he's played with others, if he wanted to make more music, he'd still choose the Beatles. And he confidently says they're going to be back in the studio in January of 1970 when the In Progress documentary, the Get Back documentary, was set to come out. That doesn't happen, as we know. But on that very same day, Lennon says that complimentary thing about his bandmates. He gets invited to this rock and roll revival festival in Toronto with Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis. And he impulsively not only agrees to attend, but offers to perform. So to do that, he hastily assembles the Plastic Ono Band. Even though they've already released that single, there's no real band there yet, right? And they perform in Toronto. And this is actually later, much later, released as Live Piece Toronto 1969. Pretty much right after that show, he announces, I'm quitting the Beatles. So John comes back. He tells his bandmates. They're like, okay, no big deal. George quit once. Ringo quit once. They always come back. Let's not freak out here. Let's just keep this quiet. Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. John goes off, as he says he's going to do, records another song with Ringo in the session, Eric Clapton. It's called Cold Turkey.
That's a stinker. That's a hard stinker.
Well, he's one of the reasons he's mad is because the Beatles rejected it already. And yes, spoiler alert, it's not that good.
Makes sense, as they should. I mean, they're kicking out some good Harrison songs at this point.
Right, exactly. And there are a few other things to do in Beatleland before this official wrap, but they're never really together for a session. You know, they do like a Christmas fan club release. They do a little promo video where they never actually appear together. And there's some overdubs on Let It Be, but John's definitely not there. And I don't think two of them or more than two of them ever get in the same room at the same time again to record until the 90s when the anthology stuff comes out. So October 1st, 1969, the record hits the shelves, but the group is effectively done, even though the press does not know it yet. It does quite well. I assume you guys know that. It was number one in the UK for 17 weeks. It was number one in the US for 11 weeks. It sold 4 million copies between September and December of that year.
Jesus Christ, 4 million copies in 4 months?
Wow, that's a lot.
Crazy. And at least a month of those are pre-orders. And it won a Grammy for Best Engineered Album. Which,
yeah.
Okay.
Huh. It's well engineered.
Just no denying it.
What won Album of the Year for a Grammy?
That's a great question. I do not know. Maybe you can look that up while I will tell you right now.
What was my man's name who engineered it?
The guy Jeff Emmerich.
Emmerich, yeah.
Cool. Would it be for 1969?
The 70 awards, though, would have awarded to 1969.
Awards. Yeah.
I just wanted to mention two other pieces of trivia here before we get into the songs. Considered titles, I mentioned Everest. They also considered the title Inclinations. They considered Turnips, Four in the Bar, and All Good Children Go to Heaven. These were working titles for Abbey Road.
Oh, wow.
By the way, the winner was Blood, Sweat, and Tears, self-titled album for 1969. Right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not familiar with it, but can't be better than this, right?
Does it have spinning wheel on it?
Just take the... I can say confidently that's
the winner for the single of the year, by the way, Phil. Single of the year. You're going to love this one. Aquarius, Let the Sunshine In.
Fuck, man. I hate that shit.
The Fifth Dimension?
Yeah. The Fifth Dimension.
Yes.
Good pull, Adam.
Thank you.
It's just obnoxious.
One more thing I wanted to mention. They clearly chose the right title for the album. Might have been influenced by the cover photo that we mentioned, which was sort of born of laziness. They couldn't really get together. They didn't want to travel. Let's just take the photo outside. Heck, let's just call it Abbey Road. As we said in the last episode, later the studio was renamed Abbey Road, sort of to capitalize on that, but that wouldn't happen for some years.
Well, maybe the lesson here, though, is that like necessity is the mother of invention.
Sure.
I also will point out an interesting thing that I had never thought about before. I have one of the first 100,000 copies of the White Album ever printed. I bought it for $2 at an estate sale. It was a fantastic find. I also got like original releases of Led Zeppelin 1 and Thriller and a bunch of and Animals. But it says recorded at EMI on that. And it never occurred to me that EMI is fucking Abbey Road.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
That was the learning for me, too. Two last little things I wanted to mention about this side. One, we've already alluded to it. And listen, I think John Lennon, pretty much throughout the 70s, was pretty crabby about the Beatles. I don't know if they were getting maybe a little closer to a reconciliation when he died, but he said on the medley, even later, I could never stand that kind of rock opera on the B-side. It's crap.
For the record, Adam, I'd like it to be added to the record that Adam made a face, like a begrudged face.
Yeah, I made a face too. Fuck John Lennon.
What's wrong with you, John Lennon? Sorry.
I think the context is that he was real adversarial through a period. Sure. And so you get a lot of really bitchy comments and even some songwriting barbs. I'm sure we'll get into it on another episode. But the last thing I wanted to mention is that when they originally sequenced the album, they were going to have the sides reversed. Side one was going to be the medley. And the album, the entire album, was going to end with the White Noise abrupt ending of I Want You, She's So Heavy. So great call on swapping that, boys.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a great call. Although my first instinct is like, what the fuck? But like, as I'm thinking about it now, I'm like, yeah, I can see some logic there, but I'm glad they didn't do that.
I also see how like Here Comes the Sun seems like a beautiful opener, and it is a beautiful opener for the second side of the record, right? Like you, again, like you're back to the record, right? You're back to that like 22-minute format that is like sort of just like a pretty appropriate length for the human attention span.
Speaking of Here Comes the Sun, let's get into these songs, and side two kicks off with Here Comes the Sun. Let's play a clip of that now.
Sun, I say it's all right.
We just ended side one with that noise, that build up from She's So Heavy. It ends abruptly. You pick up the album, you flip it over, and this is the first thing you hear on side two. It's chippy, it's cheery. It is a fantastic song. Obviously, it's a George Harrison number. And where did this song come from? Well, apparently Apple, all the Apple business dealings were steadily growing more and more tiresome. And one spring day, George played truant. And he went over to Eric Clapton's house and just sat in his yard with a borrowed acoustic guitar and was immediately inspired with Here Comes the Sun. So now this is one of those fun internet sleuth things where Data, this is Beatles nerds for you, data from two meteorological stations in London show that April 1969 set a record for sunlight hours for the entire decade. The Greenwich station recorded 189 hours for April, which was a high that was not beaten until 1984. So folks think that he put this down on paper in April of 1969.
The real question though is like, while he's writing this song, where is Clapton and where is his wife?
All right. Good point. That wasn't mentioned in the recording session notes.
Sure.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
That makes sense.
So now specifically on Monday, the 7th of July in studio number two, this is where George starts putting down this song, or at least the initial iterations of this song. And so you had George Martin in the studio, along with a guy named Phil McDonald, Jock Kurlander were the engineers this time. Only three Beatles present again. I think John Lennon was out doing his thing. They did 13 takes on the initial bass tracks of this song. Number 13 was the one that they finally kept. And on this same day, it also happened to be Ringo's 29th birthday. Again, these guys they are so young, and they're writing and recording Abbey Road. It's just unbelievable to me.
It really is. I often feel inadequate hearing this and starting to think about like, oh, I would like to start like sitting down on a piano and writing some songs. it's equal parts motivating and disheartening.
Well, in our Rod Stewart episode, there was a quote from Rod that he was 22, around 22, and he was going to give it up because he remembers reading a quote that Paul McCartney said, "If I haven't made it by 20, I'm going to quit music." And then, Jesus Christ. Oh my God, wait, 20? Good Lord.
That was like back in the day when I was like, you know, by the time I'm 24, I'm really going to have everything together. I'm really going to be just like a fully functioning adult. And here I am at 42. Like, when am I going to become a fully functioning adult again? What's that going to happen?
Never.
That ship has sailed, Tom.
It's a never-ending journey. You know, it's a long and winding road.
Yeah. Ah, well done.
It's a great tune. I do feel like it suffers a little bit. It's not the song's fault from being overplayed. So I don't consider it one of my favorite tunes to listen to. I read that it was the most played Beatles song in the digital era. Just kind of a
It's like double. Like if you look at Spotify specifically, it's at like 1.2 billion, where every other Beatles song is like, nothing else is cracked. As far as I can tell, 700 million.
Ah.
Well, so, bullshit numbers.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's an enduring song, and it's a song that people, even if they're not familiar with the Beatles, even if they can't name three other songs, it's like a song for everyone.
I will say, there's something about the tenderness of the way the intro guitar is recorded, along with the tenderness of the delivery of the opening line, that does seem like
tenderness is a really good description.
Yeah,
of the tone of the guitar, the way it's played. Yeah,
the way it's recorded. Yeah. like how loud is that mic? Like how quiet is that room? Like it's a lot of like things there. Right.
And how it fits with the subject matter, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure. Because I think one of the reasons why this is the most streamed song in the digital era is because it's an appropriate song for a very specific thing that happens, where it's like, oh, it's a sunny day. It hasn't been a sunny day in a long time. What song do I want to listen to? I'm in a good mood. I'm going to listen to Here Comes the Sun. It's very intelligent from a marketing standpoint.
It's a beautiful song.
George is like, I think Paul McCartney's Good Day Sunshine is getting all the sunshine-based plays. I need to circumvent that.
Get in on some of this.
So the Beatles, maybe more than any other band, do like attack like positive tropes in like a pretty effective way, but like in a less cliche way. You know, like they hit love real hard.
Well, I won't say it's never corny, but yeah.
They find creative ways to stay positive.
Back to the tenderness, though, I don't think this is the kind of song Paul would have written, because it's not relentlessly positive exactly. It's hopeful. It's talking about a dark time ending, and there's a like, no, I think it's going to end soon. It's not even quite here yet.
There's still that tinge of melancholy, like just enough to sort of like make that optimism kind of bounce off it.
Well, it's probably because George knew that Eric Clapton was macking on his wife while he was outside in the sun. Yeah.
Song. Are we going to talk about this guitar going through a Leslie speaker? That's pretty dope.
I heard, after hearing or reading that the guitar was being run through the Leslie, I heard that elsewhere on the album as well, once I kind of like tuned my ears to that sound.
Yeah. I have a question about a later moment. Yo, for me, the musical standout, and there's actually an isolated track, Rob, for all I know, it's your main man. Here's your bibliographic source.
Scott Fryman?
Fryman, yeah. I found these videos on YouTube that had isolated the Moog and the strings specifically for this song, and it is a really, really beautiful and charming duo specifically. And in many ways, like, I think this is something that like comes to fruition in other rock records later, is this synthesis, for pun intended, of like real instruments, real horns with fake horns, or real strings with fake strings, right? And I think this is like a very effective application of the synthesizer and instrument, but also something that's like doubling things that are happening in the string arrangement.
That's a counter melody, right?
Yeah. And you can find the ISO tracks. Like, they're great.
I think charming is a very good descriptor of this song, just in general. It's charming song. It's inoffensive. I can't imagine anybody listening to this song and being like, fuck this song. Even, you know, like, there's nothing to hate from this song. It's just so nice and good.
Well, I want to get geeky for a minute and get nerdy with
because we haven't been doing that so far.
Yeah, we haven't been doing that. No, but there's the bridge of this song has a very cool time signature, and you probably have never thought about it because you've heard the song so much and it just feels like it. You could sing the song, you can sing the notes of the song, but I broke down what is going on in the time signature in the bridge, and it goes from 11/8 to a measure of 4/4 and then a measure of 7/8 and then repeats. Now, I wouldn't be able to explain all this right now live, so what I did was I pre-recorded something. I'm going to have Rob play it to count out so you can just hear how crazy it is when you get into the bridge. One, two, three, four, 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 five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. It's wild. It feels like a very simple song, even to play it. But when you actually break down what they were doing there, it's pretty cool.
Adam, I'm so glad you brought this up because this is going to be an amazing segue into a whole bunch of shit I have to say about the next tune. But also.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Let's
just go there. Let's just, yeah.
Let's go into next is because. All right, so this song was written by John Lennon, but it's credited, as usual, to Lennon-McCartney. Apparently, John had been listening to Moonlight Sonata and made some quip to Yoko about playing that song backwards. And so he had this idea in his head, and from it came this song.
I mean, I almost think Beethoven gets a writing credit on this one. It is pretty close once that was pointed out to me.
Yeah. Electric harpsichord, A, that's a thing. B, George Martin played it on this track, and he kills it. You got more Moog in here, and there's also 9 voices. So John, Paul, and George each did a vocal track, and then they each tripled their voices so that you wind up having 9 vocals on this track.
Must have driven John nuts.
Well, you're the one with the studio diary, but I think that each one of those is them all 3 singing into one mic. And then they do that 3 times. No?
So on Friday, August 1st, they did a total of 23 takes of the basic track, which was mostly George on the harpsichord, John playing a scratch track, Paul on bass, and Ringo just acting as a metronome. And I don't have any notes on that. All I had was that it was the 9 voices. I don't know if they did 3 sets of them on the one mic or if it was 9 individuals.
I would only be surprised because I've never heard of them doing overdubbed vocals in that way. It seems like they were so good at harmony. I don't think I'm telling tales out of school here that's how they would go about it. And also to save tracks, because this is something maybe we haven't brought up in a while, a limitation of the technology is that even though you have these 8 tracks to work with and you can record to all 8 of them, and then sort of mix them together while bouncing it down to a single track of another 8-track tape.
By bouncing, other words would be like summation or...
Yeah, you put them all into one track, but then you also lose the ability to independently move different parts and volumes within that one track.
It's like an OGD frag.
And so they did a fair amount of that. But in addition to losing that ability to then mix those individual parts out, it adds some artifact of tape, like tape hiss.
The character of the gear definitely gets imparted permanently.
I didn't listen super deeply to the differences between the original mix and the 2019 mix that is also on Spotify. But at a relatively quick glance, the 2019, I think, digitally removes some of those artifacts, subtle artifacts of tape hiss. Anyway, my point is they didn't want to do that endless amounts of time.
I can see that. That makes sense.
You know, we didn't actually mention it on the previous episode, but if you listen very closely to the beginning of Octopus's Garden with that super hot guitar coming in over those licks, because it's the guitar in space, you can hear some of those artifacts of the bouncing down, and there's some weird hum and hiss that is kind of drowned out by the guitar, but in the spaces in between the notes, you can definitely hear
it. That's actually a great call, Tom. There is actually all sorts of like weirdness out there if you just basically just turn it up to 10 and hit play and try to listen to everything that isn't the guitar on Octopus's Garden. None of that needs to be there.
My theory on this song, on Because, is that the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album had just come out in May. And I think they were like, oh, you think you're the fucking Kings of Harmony? We're going to show you. We're going to show you who the real Kings of Harmony are. And they just came in and killed it with this. Jesus Christ. This harmony is out of control good. It sounds so good.
While you're out there singing our songs, we're in the lab laying it down.
Oh, coming up with the next one, right?
Yeah, how about you try to cover this one, bitches?
So Tom, this one definitely sent me down a wormhole, and this definitely like dovetails into like what you just said. So like, no doubt this is like an abject masterpiece, right? Like, that's pretty easy. I think in a strange way, I would argue this is the band's song that is most influenced by their time in India. And I'm not going to downplay the Moonlight Sonata comment, but what I think is really interesting about this, this isn't like Blue Jay Way. This is like internalized world music, right? For me, that main riff, it has a weird thing where the eighth beat feels tacked on, right? So you get a real seven feel. This sent me down a real wormhole into this idea of like poly beat and 7/8 and how it feels like it's in 6 at times, feels like it's in 8 at times. It accents the 7. It's weird. So this wound up leading me to this idea of in like Indian music of raga or the super scale. Right. There's also like a complementary idea here, like rhythmically. I don't think it really plays as well. But dude, they hit all 12 tones in this song and they pay off into like the last tone in an amazing way. So like I can literally just run it down. Right. You got C sharp minor. Right. You got C sharp. You got E. You got like what's you got the guy in the middle there. Right.
By the way, I love how Rob earlier was like, hey, one song in C sharp minor, what is it? No one knows. Not only does Phil know, but it has the entire rest of the song like charted out.
So this one really, really got to me, right? So you got the C sharp, you got the E, you got the G sharp. Those are all in the C sharp minor. Next chord is a D. I'm just reading this out of a book. I didn't like learn this myself. The next, you got a D sharp minor 7 flat 5, right? So we got there is you got a D sharp, you wind up with an F and an A. And then next, you get to a G dominant, G sharp dominant, right? So you got G, C is your new note. And you also get an F sharp. So basically, like, you've already knocked out a ton of notes, right? Like, you're already through many of the tones in the potential scale. You play an A next, you haven't hit an A note yet. Play a C sharp minor, again, nothing new. A7, right? You add the G note, you haven't played a G note yet. This is actually a fun question that Paul will answer for himself later in the song. And you said John wrote this? Found that shocking. But doesn't matter.
Yes.
The question song is answered later in the song. So he plays an A7-13, right? And the question there that is asked by the 7-13 is, does a 13 chord include the 9 and the 11 or not? They wind up answering it later, but the A7-13 hits an F sharp for the first time, so now we've got that. Then we go to the next two chords, D major, D diminished. That gives us both the D note we haven't hit yet and the F note we haven't hit yet. We haven't said a word yet, by the way. There are no lyrics yet. We're like 10 seconds into the song.
And you've hit every note on the piano, basically.
Phil, I just want to point out, Adam had the good graces to apologize for making a nerdy comment, for his super innocuous comment. And no apology from Phil when he goes into your diatribe of all the tones.
Yeah, I'm like referencing documents here. All right, so it's not until the
Your Honor,
documents.
Subclause G.
I like to enter into evidence.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Five. So it's not until the second lap where they sing, like, you know, the world is high or something, the wind is high, where they hit that A713 for the second time. And like that high wiggle note that you hear, that wow, 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 you know? Yeah, yeah. So that's like somebody going up to the B note. So like whether or not the 13 chord implies the 9 and the 11 is unclear, but it definitely implies the 9. It's documented in the song. So the only note that we've yet to hit is a B flat, right? It's the only note we haven't hit, which we hit at 1 minute and 30 seconds when it goes to love is old, love is new. And it like highlights the note you haven't hit yet in like the most profound way, where it's the note of the major chord. It's also where it kind of goes to a backbeat for the first time. So it sort of exits this like both world music thing and also this old world European thing into like rock and roll just for like 1 second. It's insane. Completely insane.
So, dear listeners, I didn't follow that either. So for all the listeners out there, I didn't know what he was talking about.
Adam had also had the forethought to pre-record something that made sense.
No.
That was brilliant.
I know exactly the point that you're talking about where they hit the B flat, the love is old, love is new, and it does sound different. There's something that happens there. That
something
like, oh,
changes.
That's
different. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So that's like the note that they've saved. They've saved that one note, that one tone the whole time.
This song is what, like a minute and 47 seconds or something like that?
Sounds about right.
No, 245, actually longer. But we have definitely talked about this song for like 4x the amount of time.
But my scree there was maybe 3-4 minutes. Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
This is why we love you, listeners, because you're willing to come along for the ride.
Okay. All right. So this song.
Oh, there's more?
The song ends on a diminished chord. It ends. The song does end, believe it or not. The song ends on a diminished chord, which gives you that super suspense.
Oh, yes.
You just want it to land on the root, and it doesn't. So it kind of leaves you in suspense. And then we move on to You Never Give Me Your Money, which is like a medley within the first song of a medley. This song has a lot of things going on in it.
You never give me your money. You only give me your funny paper. And in the middle of negotiations, you break down. Give you my number. I only give you my situation. And in the middle of investigation, I break down.
Out of college, money spent. See no future, pay no rent.
This, to me, feels like the predecessor to Band on the Run, to Uncle Albert, to some of these Paul McCartney epic songs that have all different sounding styles baked into one.
I want to compliment. For the longest time, I thought that those beginning licks, that I thought that was Paul McCartney on bass. I'm pretty sure that's George Harrison on guitar.
On the bass, I think it's the bass six.
The bass six.
And it and sounds that is why it's
amazing. Yes! Because nothing matters. Because nothing matters when you're in the Beatles, right? Nothing matters. Right. You're just like, fucking, yeah, it's great.
Dude, the bass six is such a like niche instrument.
So, that
like,
sounds so cool.
Awesome.
But when it's deployed correctly, there's nothing like it.
Maybe this is what you meant, Adam, but this is the medley that opens the medley. It's a medley a medley.
yes, exactly.
It might be the best song for me on the entire record. It's debatable, but I quite like it.
I would say that there's no better way to kick off this avalanche into the end of the album, because I feel like from here on out, they're just whipping fastballs by you. It's coming hot and heavy, and you can't stop. I cannot listen to the beginning of You Never Give Me Your Money and not listen and not to the finish. End of Your yeah. Majesty. It goes all the way through. There's no stopping it.
What I didn't quite see in the past, but I definitely thought about sort of like just scrubbing this many times is the way also in a fun way. There's like, it's something about the presentation is the like out of college money spent. That part sort of feels like a throwback to the bridge of A Day in the Life, right? Like the woke up, got out of bed.
Yeah. Totally.
It's like, okay. Like it has like a something feels like a throwback to that, feels self-referential in a very mature way, in a way that like appreciates the listener.
But they never went to college, right?
Yeah, I don't know. No, dude. They were like grade school dropouts, I'm sure. Yeah. And, you know. Yeah.
But just on a personal level, I do remember those
dedicated
lyrics
to skiffle.
Really speaking to me in that time of my life, post-college or college.
Except for the pay no rent part.
I paid plenty of rent.
Yeah, paid plenty of fucking rent.
Yeah.
Just the endless possibility of that time of your life. I think the song and the lyrics get across.
Oh, that magic feeling. Nowhere to go.
Well, John was only like 23, so.
Yeah. In all honesty.
I mean, I know I'm
that
joking.
That concept of, oh, that magic feeling, nowhere to go. The maturity to be able to write that line in your mid-20s.
Yo,
where I have
right?
not realized that until I'm in my mid-40s, where I'm like, I have nothing to do. This
and
is
this
amazing.
Is
this is so great.
He did just get married.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. Got this fucking shrew just pecking me to death. Yeah.
All right, so your couple other little quick fun facts here. The original idea was to have this song end abruptly. It was going to go on, so there's a couple earlier versions where the outro goes on for like 3 or 4 minutes, and they were just going to end it abruptly and then start stitching things. That obviously didn't happen. There are tubular bells on this song at the 1 minute 31 mark. They're in the background, but you can find on YouTube the isolated tubular bells. On the big hits, they're hitting like 3 distinct notes. Gives it a cool sound. And the honky-tonk piano was, in fact, an overdub. So Paul was not singing while he was playing the honky-tonk piano style.
I read about that. I read about that piano. I think it was actually John. They suggested that it was John and George Martin double-handing a piano. But what they did was they used an old trick that George Martin was fond of, where they slowed the tape down. This is for the overdub.
Oh, yeah.
They slowed the tape down to half, and they played it an octave below and half as fast. And that's why it gives it that like tinny saloon and really fast sound.
That's the All the Places I Remember. What's that song called?
In My Life.
Oh, diddle-ding-ding, diddle-ding-ding-ding. Yeah, okay, I got it. Okay.
Yeah, that solo rips way too hard, you know, for a human to
yeah, it's for somebody to actually play that. All right, and that brings us into Sun King.
Originally titled Here Comes the Sun King.
No way.
Yeah, which I found to be, they were like, oh, we just can't call it that. We already have Here Comes the Sun, and normally we just kick that Harrison song off the album.
John's like, I got to get in on this sun song thing. Yeah. not getting left out in the cold. Yeah.
We're printing money.
It's going to be on Jeep commercials in 2007.
Fucking Norwegian Wood. What am I going to do with this bullshit? We're really filling it with Beatles errors here. It's great. Like, we're going to get annihilated. I'd say look forward to that.
So one quick note is that, you know, I think for the remainder of the medley, they were recorded in pairs. So Sun King and Mean Mr. Mustard were recorded at one time. and Pauline Pam, and she came through the bathroom window, were recorded together similarly. I think this song, in a weird way, I think it's one of the weirdest songs on the record, but it also sounds the most modern. It sounds like modern indie pop to me. I think, like, I could imagine Real Estate or a band like that doing this.
Yeah, the different languages, it also kind of throws back to when they were doing, like, German versions of I Want to Hold Your Hand and stuff like that.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But I never tire of hearing this type of music. Just beautifully executed harmony over a very kind of simple chord structure. I love it. I cannot help but love this.
So the chord structure really isn't that simple. Like, honestly.
Okay,
though, like,
Phil, I did not mean to open the door for
you. Sorry. Yeah. It's really not. Like, it's really, like, I mean, the chords are kind of just like a 2-5 sort of thing, or like a major 7, like minor 7 thing. It's already like opening the doorways to like alternate harmony. But the real thing is the chromaticism, I would say, in the lead line, which is sort of like C, B, probably like B flat A. So it's like, it creates this like crunky little thing. Like once he actually starts saying words, we're singing all the out notes. It's super weird.
Did you happen to come across the connection between this and Fleetwood Mac's Albatross?
Dude, I did. And I actually think that's an interesting comp. And Fleetwood Mac's Albatross, which, by the way, is like pre-Stevie Nicks,
right,
pre-Lindsey
Green era.
Yeah.
Actually, a listener wrote into us about it, and we talked about it briefly. Yeah, it is cool.
Dude, it's cool. It's super cool. I mean, it is a very cool. And I totally see it, especially the very intro, like both the riff and the tone of the riff. Like,
yeah,
sort
if you
of
play
like
the first 15 seconds of both songs, yep, you'll hear a connection, obviously.
Is there any explanation as to why they chose to sing in multiple languages and also like incorrectly sing in multiple languages?
I was looking on the internet and it was a lot of speculation. That's all I was really getting.
Another callback I wanted to mention is that just to give you like a window into the songcraft, right? Remember on the Get Back documentary, I was reminded of this in the research, that they're jamming over this riff and John's singing Don't Let Me Down over this riff initially.
Huh. Interesting. That was a better idea to do the actual Don't Let Me Down, which is one of my top five Beatles songs.
Oh, yeah, so great. They definitely do have like the open E major vibe, which is also, I would say, sort of adjacent to Day Tripper, which is, you know, maybe like just John doing the John thing with what I feel like is like a really a Paul song. But it's pretty clear to me. I don't know the song as well as I think I do. It's always made.
Let's keep
me.
It moving.
No.
Two. No, you got more to say?
No, I don't. We're in deep here, guys. So.
Yeah, you think so?
We're the looking glass here, people.
Rob hasn't eaten in seven and a half hours. He's like,
God, we're going to the next fucking song.
Let's keep it moving to Mean Mr. Mustard.
Mean Mr. Mustard sleeps in the park, shaves in the dark, trying to save paper. Sheeps in a hole in the road, saving up to buy some clothes. Keeps a 10-bob note up his nose. Such a mean old man. Such a mean old man.
This is my favorite Beatles melody to sing, is the harmony over the his sister Pam works in a shop, yeah, she never stops. It's nursery rhyme shit, I know, but I love this song. It's so dumb, and I love it so much.
This is definitely the low point on the record for me, but
I love this song.
Well, there's got to be a low point, right? But what about that distorted bass? Like he's using a distortion pedal, I think, on that bass, right?
So I think that, I mean, we're just talking about like tones. I do agree. Yeah, there's a distortion on the bass. I think it's actually really cool. And I like the way it's like doubled with the piano. And I think it sort of harkens back to some of the tones you hear on the first side, right? The come together tones and some, not quite She's So Heavy, but I like the way the sounds are connected from side one to side two in this disjointed way.
I thought that bass tone was not necessarily a distortion, but the microphone being overwhelmed by the loudness of the bass cabinet and being so close that the diaphragm of the microphone is literally distorting from the sound of the bass.
I don't know. It sounds like a pretty strong effect to me, but it's possible.
Yeah. I didn't research that, so I don't know for sure. But again, I really like this song. Again, I know it's not a real song, and this is where we get it deep into the McCartney Lennon cast off songs that they just stitched together to make something amazing.
I mean, both of these are basically songs about like time John spent in India, right? This is like the John section, right? Like Sun King is an old song. Not old, but like something that had been around, right? But what do we say it had been called? Like Here Comes the Sun King originally. And then Mean Mr. Mustard is like a song about, I guess it's an experience John had in India, as is Polythene Pam. John thinks of both of these as like throwaways. And that's where like the fun, right? Like Her Majesty's supposed to be wedged in between there, right? Her Majesty is supposed to be between Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam.
Yeah, I think that like first chord that doesn't sound like it's supposed to be in Her Majesty.
After hearing that note, it makes sense like from a sequential standpoint, but I don't really understand the history of what happened to Her Majesty. Like, did they abandon it? Like, why is
it? Yes.
Yeah.
I have the detail on that.
Literally on the floor.
Yeah. The, what happened with that is that, so like you said, it was originally meant to be between Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. You get the big hit chord at the beginning of Her Majesty, and that was intended to effectively replace what we get, mm-hmm. the Polythene Pam chord, right? They had a note on the tape that said, please do not include in the final master for Her Majesty. So at some point, they just decided it wasn't worth including. They wrote it on the little thing to the Apple engineer when he was cobbling together the final playback that they were going to get. But there was this rule, the engineers had been trained over years, right, to never delete anything.
Don't throw it away. Yeah.
Do not throw it away. So they just put it at the end of the tape, and they intending to like hit stop or just drop it later. But they sort of forgot, tape kept playing, and this is during the final playback, and the Beatles were like, that's awesome. We got to do that.
I think it was beyond even a rule. I believe that they had like a clause in their contract that they're like, you cannot... producers cannot delete our material without our say-so. And so it was kind of like, well, they put it here, so I have to conclude it.
I got to find a home for this on the tape, right? Like, yeah.
One of the best accidental happenstances in music history. I love the
idea. It is kind of fun. I sort of want to go back and like sort of listen to those in the, I guess, intended but destroyed order.
No, that would sap the energy, I think, a lot. Because I think the energy from Mean Mr. Mustard into Polythene Pam, it carries that energy through.
When, because Mean Mr. Mustard's already a bit of, I don't want to use the term throwaway, because I think everything all works together. But I feel like if you had that and then into Her Majesty, yeah, I agree there could be some momentum hit at that point in the record.
They're both obviously not full songs. They're just ideas, little snippets that are thrown out there.
Yeah, they're not great ideas either.
And I think John would agree with you. I think John would agree with you.
Yeah, as is Polythene Pam, by the way. Polythene Pam is like a half-second idea.
He didn't seem like he was that into any part of this medley, really. So
the most interesting thing about Polythene Pam that I learned is that it's not really polythene, it's polyethylene, right? Like, that's what we call it.
Hmm. Is he like... a Walter White character here.
I don't know. It's like a polymer. It's like a plastic.
No, it just means plastic. It's a type of plastic. It supposedly comes from a woman they met back in the Hamburg days who liked to eat plastic. That was her weird habit.
My strange addiction.
Yeah, my strange addiction. Exactly. Yeah.
Tom, it's all about meth with you, isn't it?
I mean, listen, I'm trying to get through a 4-hour taping session.
Let's
here.
Play a clip of Polythene Pam. Yeah, these are the low points. This one's fun. The solo rips on this one.
Let's be honest. This is just the lead into She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. You hear this song, you're like, okay, yes. I can make it through 45 seconds of this because I know what's coming.
I never fast forward anything on this album, but if I had to, I would fast forward it into that sort of drum break into Bathroom Window. Because yes, it is. It's like an on-ramp.
It's funny you say that because even if you're like, if you're skipping through the record, they cut it to the point you want.
Totally.
Right? Where it's like, oh,
that's a great call. Yeah.
That's a good point. Paul was like, this is my part. This is not your part.
Yeah, no, totally.
Even just the construction of this song, the way that they keep stopping and pulling back to the dun, dun, dun hits, it saps all the momentum. Like, from a standpoint of just trying to carry momentum through until you get to the actual good song of She Came Into the Bathroom Window, it doesn't even really accomplish that.
Well,
it's, yeah.
That said, I do think Polythene Pam sounds a little more like other music that's out there or maybe would be created. I mean, a band we have not mentioned yet that we covered was Kinks and Village Green Preservation Society. I think the Beatles had at least some awareness. This reminds me a little bit of a Kinks song, especially that arrangement detail you just mentioned, Tom, where they're dropping out to that kind of distorted acoustic, or maybe it's clean electric guitar pushed a little bit. That reminds me of something the Kinks would do. And I feel like Mean Mr. Mustard, it doesn't feel like present day music is drawing from that. But I think this song you could probably draw some lines from.
So you're telling me you like Polythene Pam more than Mean Mr. Mustard?
Well, as I said, the solo rips. I feel like there's almost nothing to like in Mean Mr. Mustard.
Tom, for the record, I'm with you. I just think there's something about the bass fuzz and the piano double and the alliteration of the lyrics that I just find charming.
I'm not saying it's bad. It's all in context.
We're definitely splitting hairs here, you know, sure. So.
Can we get into the song that Phil, Adam, and I covered back in the day in our band? Oh, she came in through the bathroom window.
Okay, I take it back what I said before. This is actually the highlight. This is my favorite song.
Hell yeah.
This is your favorite song in the medley?
I think on the whole record.
On the whole record?
Yeah.
Oh.
Dude, the second verse slaps.
It's hard to say it's a favorite song because is it even a full song? But to me, that lead-in is among my favorite moments. Like, there's something about the energy that goes, like when it drops into this song, you just feel like something is happening and it's hip and it vibes really hard.
Dude, to get back to what Adam said, that second verse is funk. That bass on the second verse is straight up funk.
The rhythm section is badass.
Killing it.
Did this in another band that never came to fruition, but we had learned this, and the first time we came together to rehearse it, you know, everything's loud. You're in a room. Everybody got their instruments. It's all electric. And when the bass player and the drummer locked in on that second verse, like everyone's heads snapped around like, oh shit, like this, this grooves. Like it was badass. She said she'd always been a dancer. She worked at 15 clubs a day. And though she thought I knew the answer, well, I knew.
Is there another moment in the Beatles catalog? And the moment that we're talking about is like 13 seconds long, that you actually get like some real head nod going
like
on.
Some stank ass,
face,
like,
you know?
Oh, stank, yeah.
I don't think that there is.
Lady Madonna, that might be the only contender, is when the drums come in. Lady Madonna definitely has a groove.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that's
but
fair.
Not
that's
as good as this one.
It's a good comp.
Well, but it encapsulates what I love about this album, which is that you can't take this, you can't like decontextualize this stuff, because in and of itself, if you listen to this song, it's a banger, but I think it's what comes before, it's like the setup, it's like the tension and release, so that when you're listening to it together, like once it drops, it just, man, it really hits hard, and you might not get that if you just listen to it by itself, or if they decided, hey, let's like turn this into a 4-minute, 5-minute song. Like,
so here's what I learned this week, is that Polythene Pam into She Came In the Bathroom Window were like recorded as a pair from the 25th to the 30th of July in 69. Whereas like what seems unclear to me is when Mean Mr. Mustard was recorded, because it seems like Sun King was recorded like a few days earlier. So like,
no, those were recorded as a pair as well.
Those were recorded as a pair as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Sun King and Mean Mustard.
I don't know what 20, day,
yeah,
but
yeah,
yes,
sure,
but
yeah, shortly
then, yeah.
Before. Yeah, so like is Polythene Pam good or bad?
Well, I think what I'm reacting to is is this moment of, oh, Paul is back to rescue us. That's how I feel when I'm listening to it. And I hope this is obvious to anyone listening, but these are not meant to be listened to in isolation. We're not at all suggesting right. that. In fact, I had to kind of look at my Spotify display a little more often this week to just fully understand when the track had actually changed. Because why would you pay that much attention to it? I'm not even sure if someone using the record would pay that much attention to it, right? But my feeling is like, thank God, McCartney's back. I know the next couple songs are going to bring it home super strong. I'm really excited. It's like the high point of the record in that sense.
Yes.
I would never listen to this album this way. But if I was putting any song on the medley on a playlist, it would be She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. It's the one that holds up on its own the most. Mm-hmm. The rest of them are, they can't be separated from the whole. This one could be separated from the whole, and it could still hold up. It just wouldn't be realizing its full potential.
Okay, let's keep it rolling to Golden Slumbers / Carry That Weight, also recorded together. Let's play a clip.
Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep pretty darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby.
This is the moment on the album when I get sad.
Yes.
I mentioned at the top where, because I hear that ding, ding, and I immediately know, I'm like, oh, we're on our way out. This is it. Get ready. It's all going to end. I mean, it's simultaneously happy and sad.
I'm like getting chills now, honestly, just thinking about the end of this. And I've heard this a million times.
Yeah,
and
right.
I knew we were going to talk about it. But I'm like getting chills just thinking about the start of this like sort of final medley.
Yeah. Final movement.
Adam, I think it speaks maybe to your personality. I'm going to do a little like armchair psychiatrist thing here.
By the numbers? But a little by the numbers?
No. Listen, his number is sad, whatever that number would be. But in terms of the album, I have this marked as this is the climax of the album. Golden Slumbers into Carry That Weight, I have listed as the climax of the album. And the fact that you were saying that the climax makes you sad because you're already looking past the climax to right. the end of it. Again, there's a whole lot of emotional weight going on.
You're saying I can't experience happiness when it's right there in front of me that I have to.
Not even that. I think part of it is just that the Beatles have been your favorite band forever. And so you kind of can't separate the fact that you're like, well, this is the last Beatles we're ever going to get. From the songs, but
and that's the sentiment, yeah.
But it's such a shame too, because John is notably absent from much of this segment, or at least these songs in tandem. He wasn't in on this, and I don't think he liked any of this stuff. Like if you look back, there's so many quotes about this where he's just like, that was just another Paul thing, that whatever. He really was very divested by this point. And you know, I think that adds an element of emotion to it in a way.
Well, can we talk about where this one came from? So Paul, there's a story about Paul visiting his father and his father's new wife and their new child, and he finds this song on the piano by a guy called Thomas Decker. It's called Cradle Song. Now, he can't read music, but he can see the lyrics. And the lyrics say, golden slumbers, kiss your eyes. Smiles awake you when you rise. Sleep pretty wantons. Sorry, wantons. Do not cry.
Sleep pretty wantons.
I got wantons on the brain. And I will sing a lullaby. Now, the song was from a play that this guy wrote like back in Shakespeare's time, but he pretty much lifted it directly.
That's wild.
And was like, I'll write a new song with that, with those lyrics.
At that point, who's left to sue? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is 600 years old.
That's what Paul thought until.
Right.
Yeah. Well, another comment is that Paul's really feeling himself on this vocal, on the Golden Slumbers vocal specifically. He has a lot of modes of his voice, and I think we kind of get all of them throughout this record. I didn't mention it, but one of the reasons I like Maxwell's Silver Hammer is because it's kind of a delicate vocal for him. Then it's followed up by the Oh Darling super rock and roll thing. I just feel like he's at his haughtiest on Golden Slumbers while as it's peaking.
Well, and he's also trying really hard to dig in on, I don't know if it's like the second or third line, but you know, when he runs through it, you can tell he's trying to add some like grit in his voice to a song that is very
miles away.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a little bit highfalutin, I guess, but I think it works.
Dude, if anybody gets the falute high, it's fucking Paul McCartney right at the end of his last album.
He's taking a victory lap.
That's a t-shirt. Yeah.
This really is the difference between like records today and records 45 years ago, though, right? 50 years ago. It's like, this wouldn't pass today. Like, this is out of the wiggle in his voice is unacceptable. But it, like, this is the sound of a human being singing, right? Like,
yeah. And really emoting.
Like, no one's going to do it better than this, right?
Yeah.
Well, I assume everyone saw the news article about the now far past Super Bowl where Alicia Keys's little vocal scratch got immediately erased on the internet. Did you guys see
that? Yeah, the YouTube version. They like fucking auto-corrected it basically, right?
It was just the mildest voice crack at the beginning of her take. Completely human, completely
normal.
She hit
normal. A bad note at the beginning of the song.
No. Even saying bad note, I think, is an overstatement of what it was, though, if you actually go listen to it. It was just a little extra waver.
Coming in cold? Yeah.
Or even a lack of appreciation of what it is actually like to perform.
To be a human performer.
In an environment like that, where you're like, I don't know what the sound is like. She probably can't hear herself very well.
I actually did think that was something that was cool about that performance, because you could definitely tell, like, Usher didn't have the sort of like guide rails, like the bumpers that people normally had. Like, again, you could tell this was the sound of a human singing. You could tell he had worked this, you know, in Vegas for a long time.
Yeah, and also, to put it in context, the sound of like Alicia Keys is a fucking amazing voice. She is a generational talent on the piano and vocally. Even those people get tripped up sometimes. Not everybody's great all the time. So as you listen to any Chop albums, to your listeners, just
keep that in mind.
Okay. And let's round the corner here and bring it home almost to the next song. It's called The End.
Wait, do we not talk about, we didn't really talk about Carry That Weight. We talked a little bit about Golden Slumbers. The one comment I have to make about Carry That Weight, and I do think it is an important comment, is this song sounds like four friends singing together. And I do think that in all of the turmoil of the Beatles' dissolution, it does get glossed over that these are four friends. And that really comes across in this album, in this particular track.
That's a great call.
It sounds very barroom. Hey, we're just all singing together.
They turned Ringo up.
Yeah.
And they're going to carry the weight of this experience for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Yes, but I like songs like this because it's very like literal. You know, you can think of like the Carry the Weight in the grandiose sense, but he was also writing about like all this shit with businesses being very hard to manage. And I think it was very much a snapshot of like, this is fucking hard right now, like, to try to be in the Beatles, but also trying to make it a business entity. We're dealing with fucking huckster managers. You know, I kind of like that there's not a lot of pretense to that part of it, that it's just, but also reprising some of the motifs from earlier in the album.
Let's round the corner and get to almost the last song. This one is called The End.
I remember, Rob, your high school yearbook quote was go and face the strange.
Turn and face the strange. Close.
I'm sorry. Turn and face the strange. Tom, yours was a Bob Marley line.
No, it was
like
not.
When the music hits you? No?
No. Mine was you run and you run to catch up with the sun, but it's sinking and racing around to come up behind you again, because I was a maudlin 17-year-old. Like, I'm getting so old. Oh, no.
Phil's was, have you ever heard a diminished sixth chord?
But I want to hear Adam try one more just to see if he can be wrong three times.
No, all right, I'm done now. Screw you guys. I hate you. God, yeah. Phil, what was yours? Do you remember?
I feel like what I remember is I tried to do some Counting Crows quote. They said it was too long.
Oh, God. I need a raincoat.
And in retrospect, I'm glad. You know, it's pretty narcissistic. I'm going to go hang myself in the attic now.
My point was that my quote was, of course, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you
make. That's a strong, strong, strong player.
It's a very, but just the fact that I was obsessed with this album at 18 years old, I'd listened to it 100 times already.
Can we point out that when you wrote that quote, Adam, the love you make was actually zero at that time?
Yes.
Well, he was stocking it. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes you got to backfill. So he's like, you know, you're setting out a foundation. You know?
You got to take, like, and take and take until.
Yeah. When you're skiing, you want to know, like, what the base pack is. You know what I mean? Same thing.
Okay. Can we just set the stage for this song? And then I would like to tell my personal story.
Yes.
No.
This is Ringo's first and only drum solo. It's a song of solos. I didn't realize that until this week. It's all four members taking a solo in order, basically.
Yeah.
What's Paul's solo?
They all three of them take a guitar solo.
He plays guitar, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's actually the first guitar, Harrison's the second guitar, and then Lennon gets a little few licks in.
So I have to get this in here, because this is my one complaint on side two of the album. I do not like the transition from Carry That Weight into the end. I think it is too abrupt. It is too jarring. They didn't do enough to stitch it together. And every time it bumps me, because you're in one vibe and then it just immediately cuts into this other vibe that I don't like.
I'll grant that.
I'll give you that. Yeah.
They could have carried that Leslie over somehow.
Should have worked for a couple more months. How dare you?
Somebody at one point in my life planted the seed that Clapton was playing these solos on this song. And for the longest time,
I heard that too. Yeah.
I would refuse to like this for that reason. And then when I found out that it wasn't him, I liked it so much more.
Yeah, you're a man of taste, by the way, a man of taste and principles.
And then, of course, the Beastie Boys, you know, sort of brought new life to it in Paul's Boutique.
It's a fun song, it's a jam song, but knowing that they all very purposely took a solo, Ringo had never taken a solo. He was even like, when they suggested, he's like, I don't do solos. And then he listened to Inagata De Vida and he stole that solo. But
that's awesome.
But here's the thing, because I listened to it a bunch of times to try to see. I heard that the order was McCartney, Harrison, Lennon on guitar solos. So interesting idea, right? But I have to be honest, I can't quite pick out which one is which. Because one, there's two like amazing little bits of lickage in the solo, and then a couple other guys just kind of making noise. So I want to believe that that's Harrison, but I'm just not 100% sure.
So that is the ultimate McCartney boosh, by the way. He's like, I'm going to play your instruments and I'm going to be indistinguishable from the rest of you guys on the solos on your own instruments. Why don't you guys hop on the bass and see how you do, assholes? Which John actually does okay on that, but still.
Well, I watched a live performance of this recently. It was probably from like the last 15 years where Paul's doing the song with a million orchestral players and all the shit.
Is there a bass trombone?
Two. His budget's a little higher now. They could afford that. But when the solos start, he gets up off the piano and he runs back to the guitar rack and picks up an instrument. And so I was like, oh, you know, he's going to pick up his bass or something, pick up a Rickenbacker. And he picks up a guitar. And I was just like, what the fuck is he doing? And he starts playing the solo. And it was only then that I realized that he actually was playing guitar on this. Like, I didn't even know that until sort of recently.
So my little personal story, I mean, we haven't talked about it. We've all liked this record for a very long time. I was listening to this at 17 as well. But my story comes from, I think I was around 25. I was probably going out to meet you guys for drinks in San Francisco, and I was waiting at a bus stop on a Wednesday night or something, waiting for the long-ass bus ride to come meet you guys and have beers. I was by myself. And this young woman pulls up with the windows down, which is odd, first of all, in San Francisco because it's cold as hell. And she's blasting, it's the drum solo section of the end. And we just kind of make eye contact at the stoplight. I'm at the bus stop. I'm obviously poor. She must have been at least 5 years older than me, like slightly more mature and good looking. And she's rocking out and I'm rocking out. And she goes, you want to get in? And I did. I got in her car. It's my only hitchhiking experience ever. She basically just took me down the bus line. And we listened to the rest of the record for the next whatever 5 minutes it was. I don't even think we talked. I definitely did not get her name or her number. And then I just got out 20 blocks later, and that was that.
That's awesome.
She's like, I just pick up this guy who was air drumming the solo to sign the car.
That was one of the things I loved about first moving to San Francisco. Because if you were in Philly and there was a chick rocking out to the end and you happened to look over at her, she'd be like, what the fuck are you looking at? Not if it like hop on into the car. It would have been, what's your goddamn problem?
Okay. And this is an example of Ringo's drums being recorded in stereo. You really hear the drums in stereo in a really cool way here. And I do think it's a really cool solo, although it is similar to the Inagata DeVita solo, drum solo, which was on the radio at the time. Ringo made it cool with the drummer later, I think. He was like, yeah, that's fine, man. But okay, let's round this one out with the last track, the secret track, if you will. It's called Her Majesty.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl. Someday I'm gonna make a mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make a mine.
The first secret track, possibly.
Well, yeah, we already talked about how it was an accident that it came at the end of the tape, but I was wondering as well if this, yeah, it was a first, probably for a couple reasons. Secret track, there's a long pause between the end of the last song and the beginning of this one. So it has a secret track vibe, which became really popular and trendy later. But I was just going to say also, you know, we talk sometimes about the template for a rock record. And maybe the most common would be to end it with a song like Day in the Life, a big bombastic song. And that's a very common way to end a rock record. But there's this other way to end a rock record, which is like this, with the really short little acoustic ditty. This might be the first time that happened, right?
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, that opening punch chord, and I don't know if it was, it's certainly not intentional because of the way that it was done, but in my head, I always pictured that, like, that was the replacement for what would be the last bump, 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 that they don't hit the last bump at the end. And that sort of big orchestral hit at the beginning, like, replaces the bomb. It's like it's a nice little playful thing.
Yeah, but it actually turns out to be wrong, though, right? The white, where you want to punch that in is at the end of Mean Mr. Mustard. Mean Mr. Mustard has, like, a punch.
No, no. What Tom's saying is also correct, though, even though it was not designed that way. It's a self-contained piece where they purposely ended abruptly, thinking that Polythene Pan was going to come in.
But the first note...
But it also could work as a loop.
The first note of that big correct. Orchestral hit is what should be the last note that is unhit at the end of the song.
That definitely worked. Yeah, agreed. 100%. Yeah.
So it's like puzzle pieces that they just happen to rearrange, but because the puzzle pieces already had the little female and male parts at the end, it still makes sense.
They're very happy with them, yeah.
Very playful. And I've always loved... I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I got to get a belly full of wine. I don't know if you guys had the same experience, but like the first time telling my now wife that I loved her, I definitely was like, I got to get a little fucking liquid courage going on before I'm going to do this. This is not the easiest thing to say, especially if you don't know if you're going to hear it back.
For me, it was a belly full of, Magic Hat number 9 or like Sierra Nevada. But story still stands.
Okay, I think we've gabbed quite enough.
Oh my goodness, have we?
Stick around for part 3. The debrief.
The debrief.
Are we going to vote? What's going on here?
Yes. All right. Let's give our final thoughts here. Let's vote. Do you really need to hear Abbey Road before you die? Tom, what say you?
I think there's a different question that is pertinent here, is this the best Beatles album? And because clearly you need to hear this before you die. That's a stupid question to ask. Do you need to hear this before you die? Yes, you need to hear this before you die. Is this the best Beatles album? I think it's my favorite. I don't know if I'd say it's the best, but I think it's my favorite Beatles album. And it is the one that I go back to more consistently than the others in terms of an album experience and not individual song experience. So clearly you need to hear this before you die. And if you were to put a gun to my head and say, listen to one Beatles album right now and get a guaranteed smile on your face or I'm going to shoot you. I don't know why somebody would do that, but if they did, I would put on Abbey Road.
I'll second everything Tom said.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
You can tell it's been 4 hours of recording.
I mean, this is like my desert island album. You should definitely listen. I mean, what are you doing? If you haven't listened to this album, what the fuck are you doing?
Phil?
I'm gonna throw a nugget in for anybody that's actually still listening, right? So way earlier we mentioned the Beatles doing some work in the Trident Studios. I think they maybe did some like work for like She's So Heavy and maybe like Ballad of John and Yoko. There's a great documentary called The Trident Piano about Elton John and Queen and the work in that studio. It's really fun. So if you're also 4 hours in,
what chord extensions did they use in their music?
Well, I would guess all of them. Just keep going right up until all the notes.
Is it the best Beatles record or not? That was a good. Tom correctly diverted us, and then we just dropped it. Is it the best or not?
I actually did think about that. Under no circumstance can I put it lower than 3, and I'm fighting to push it down at that circumstance. And under that.
So that's a no
predicament.
Just pick a side. It's okay. We're not going to hold you to it, except when we make fun of you for it in several episodes after this.
I would say it's my third favorite Beatles record, but it might be the best Beatles record. Yes, is there a difference?
Okay, fair enough.
I can't.
Okay. I also think it's the best Beatles record. I think the album cover helps a hell of a lot. It is kind of undisputedly the best album cover of all time. So that's certainly helping.
You don't like the Mystery Tour cover?
Look, I mean, it inspired the Chili Peppers to put tube socks on their dicks and walk across the street. Yeah, yeah. You know, has to be the
best.
Right?
It's got nothing on Can't Buy a Thrill, personally, but you know.
Oh, God. What day is it?
So, yes, obviously, you should listen to Abbey Road. I think we've gotten that point across to you, dear listener.
Jesus.
What are you doing with Get Your Life and Beatles nerds out there? I know you're out there and I know you are still listening because we have 17 more pieces of trivia. No, I'm just joking. But if you want to tell us more, we do want to learn more. We've been listening to this record for 30 plus years incessantly, and yet we still found lots and lots of new information this week, which is the really cool part about doing this show. We love doing it. Thank you so much. So please write in, tell us what you think, tell us what we may have gotten wrong, and tell us more Beatles lore. We can't get enough. Okay, last thing to do is determine what we shall be turning our attention to next week. Tom, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Rob. I have the Albinator. I'm not going to make a pithy comment because it is currently eating the dinner that I should have ate 3 hours ago. And I'm going to kill it if it continues to munch away at my delicious leftover chili. Without any further ado, drum roll, please. We will be listening to the album is Vivid by the band Living Color. Not to be confused with In Living Color, the 90s sketch comedy show. Homie does, in fact, play that. It will be Living Color. The album is
Homie
Vivid.
Shall be playing this many times this week.
Yes, Homie shall be playing. Yes.
Tom, enjoy that cold turkey, dude. Enjoy that cold turkey.
Okay, I hope it's not too far of a fall here.
I'm really afraid that the album doesn't even have one good song.
One more thing before we close it. I wanted to mention that we compiled a little Beatles album that never was. We did it on the side. We're not going to talk anymore about it, but it is linked in the notes. It's some of the songs that the band was working on. They were working on these song arrangements, and we can imagine that if they had gotten back together in 1970 and gone to the studio again, these are some of the songs that they would have compiled into a record. So enjoy that if you like.
Awesome.
For everyone here at 1001 Album Complaints, thank you for hanging in on this extra long one. By the way, I'm just looking at my DAW and
it's smoking.
You know what? I actually forgot to hit record for the second part of this one, so I'm sorry.
I was going to say, it's coming perilously close to being exactly where the other one was, so we really cut this in half
I agree.
Nice.
Okay. We're going to close it out now. For everyone at the show, thank you for listening. We love you. And I've been Rob.
I've been Tom.
I'm Alan.
I'm Adam.
And I am Phil.
Boosh.